are listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Both of them.
There are two of us at the moment.
Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page.
How you doing, Mike?
Doing great. And over here on my left, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And Bobby and Rob,
they're in transit somewhere, aren't they?
They're in transit on their way. I think they stopped for coffee.
Or they might have stopped off at a pub now, Bobby.
Went to the library.
Yeah, I don't think it's the library.
Or a motel.
That opens a lot of doors there.
But anyhow,
well, you see, if Bobby's not here, Andrew takes his spot.
Well, somebody has to.
Well, anyhow, we decided rather than just to sit around and wait, we're going to just start the podcast and let them catch up.
Now, did we get any questions for Bobby or Rob for this week?
No. No questions.
Then we're safe.
We got a couple questions, but no questions for Robbie or Bob in general. We actually got, which I can wait till they get there, but we can start off with both you and Martin. Listener wrote in and wanted to know if we had any client horror stories because they followed our theme of horror stories on the road, in the studio. And so thinking about client horror stories, and being post-production,
yeah.
I've got a gazillion horror stories about working with clients, but I want to open up to you guys. You guys have any?
Yeah, I do, actually. You brought straight to my mind was when I came to America in the 80s, Brian Fairweather, my partner, and I were sort of known as producers, so they, I don't know how that happened, but Capitol Records asked us to produce a band called Bone Symphony, which were a techno band, and they thought we'll use two English guys to produce them. Well, we did an EP for them, and at the end of the EP, the record company decided, without even hearing the tracks, that they weren't going to pay for anything. It was like they just weren't going to pay for anything, and they just thought we'd do everything for free. So, long story short, I hid the master tapes. I took them out of the studio late at night and went on in hiding. I literally took the master tapes and hid for 2 weeks until Capitol Records started calling the management going, you know, you can't do this. And we said, well, we have. And then they paid all the bills. But that was a terrifying time because I felt like a fugitive. It was very brave, but terrifying too.
That's pretty bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seemed the only thing we could do.
I don't know if you
started. Oh, bloody. Come on.
Oh, here they come.
Gracious me.
Bobby and Rob just got here.
Hello, Mike.
We were waiting for
and
that.
And next to Martin, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, Mike.
That was very sexy, actually, Bobby.
Well, I figured we'd just kind of start, and when you showed up, you'd join us, you know.
And here we are.
We keep going.
And if anyone doubts that the audio podcast supports carpooling, now they don't have to worry.
Except we're really saving gas. We came on a bicycle.
That's right.
We were just talking about some client horror stories because we had a listener write in, wanted to know if we had any horror stories with clients.
Ah, as in they make you late for a podcast?
For instance?
There you go.
For instance? I've heard of that happening. That hasn't happened to me for at least a half hour.
And Martin was just talking about how he was on the lam for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I just to bring you two guys into the picture, I just, when I first came here, I was producing an album, and the record company wasn't paying for the album to be done. So I took the master tapes and went into hiding for a couple of weeks, and it was quite thrilling, but also quite fearful. But that was a bit of a horrific story. They did eventually pay for everything, but desperate situation to have to steal the masters. And
did you take them home? Or
I took them home, but and of course they called my telephone literally for about, you know, every single 20 minutes, and I didn't pick up the phone. And I did put the master tapes in a friend's house. Because I thought I might get raided.
Yeah, kick in the door.
It worked, though. It actually worked. They became very nice, and they paid the bills, and the record was released. It's terrible that we had to get to that situation, but that's what it happens sometimes when you're dealing with corporations.
Well, it's a traditional sort of hostage drama, basically.
Yes,
it was. That has been proven to work over the years.
And it did this time.
Well, really, that's the only leverage you got. When you get to that moment in time, you're only as good as your product.
Actually, Mike, that's so true. You know, getting a little serious about it again, even the band that we were producing said, you know, we're into you taking the tapes away, because they felt, you know, like this is their art and everybody being stopped. So, you know, unless you do those things, sometimes they don't really relate to it, do they? You know, unfortunately.
Do you have any horror stories with clients there, Rob? Besides
horror stories with clients. Give me a second to think. Did Andrew already do one?
Well, no, I haven't. Well, from way back in my just paying the bills with any work I could get, I was doing some filling in at a post house doing sound effects on ads. And I did an ad for the Play-Doh McDonald's drive-through set.
Are you serious?
And so it was basically a little McDonald's with Play-Doh. So one of the things I had was a hamburger maker. And in the ad, a kid puts a little lump of brown Play-Doh in the hamburger maker, pulls down the lever, and out comes a beautifully shaped hamburger patty made out of brown Play-Doh. There was a conference call that lasted for over an hour with three people in different locations to decide which sizzle sound we would use for when the kid pulled the lever to make his Play-Doh hamburger.
Oh, no.
I think we spent about 8 hours on that commercial, and it just...
Like...
And they were all very nice about it, but, I mean, it just being in a room, and it's that important, and it's just having a really hard time kind of getting with how important that sizzle sound was.
Was it like, that doesn't say beef enough?
Yeah, I mean, and there was a choice of about five. You know, it's not like I'm going through 500 sizzle sounds. We had five of them, and we liked them all.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one. I don't know. And get somebody else on the phone. And that was good.
Well, that actually reminded me of one, which was kind of similar, where I was doing some work for a company that I shouldn't really give the name away.
I've already given a name away. You? Yeah, you've got
well,
to go
just,
with it.
It rhymes with Glizney.
I was just kidding. I didn't mention any name.
Oh, you didn't mention any name?
No. Oh, I know.
You know who it is?
I think so,
you
yeah.
think so?
Not sure, though.
I'm still guessing.
Yeah, it must be orange.
Well, anyway,
orange.
They're legendary for
paying
doing
late?
Things by committee. Well, no. Well, there is legendary for that, too. You've done work for them, I see.
Never.
Never.
The Gripe Show, this should be called, shouldn't it?
We love
no, they're
now,
legendary so. For doing everything by committee, which is kind of what Andrew was describing. But we've done a few big projects for them. One of them was a huge stage show for one of their big theaters. And it got down to the point where every note of every instrument, every possible aspect of it got scrutinized to the point where you completely lost track of what you were even working on.
Right.
It's like if you're looking at a picture and you get an inch away from it, you know, like a wall-sized picture, you get an inch away from it, you don't even notice the picture anymore. You're just looking at the little particles that make it up.
Wood for the trees sort of thing.
Yeah. But that's what ended up happening. When you pull music apart enough, you start to lose sight of, you know, what was cool about it or not cool about it or what the emotional response from it was. You just lose all objectivity. And they used to just beat stuff into the ground. And particularly for this stage show, they would have hour-long conversations about one note or two notes. Or
jeez.
When recording a vocal demo, you know, the decision of does the singer go up here or down here in an ad-lib became like planning an invasion or something. Everything was just so complicated. And when it was all done, it ended up being a really fun show the kids would love. But you just couldn't believe how much turmoil went into creating it.
See,
and I just remember thinking the whole time, it didn't really have to be this way.
Well, there's a lot of people, though, especially with that particular company, because I've done a lot of work with them, that have to justify their position.
Oh, all the time.
By saying something.
Yep.
And there's just a lot of mid-level and executives and smaller executives.
It's a bit like you leading the podcast, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is.
You have to make your point early on that you are the master of everything.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I didn't get to do the beatings today, so.
Obviously, now we can see the leather he's in. if it was a visual podcast.
Well, Rodriguez written across the front.
How did we get you two sitting next to each other again?
Because it's fun.
Bobby.
Yeah, a very similar... Pretty much shared everyone else's situation. Same as Pager. I was mixing a record for somebody and the record company looked like they was folding and rolling over and I took the DATs and I was at Capitol and I took the DATs and put
Capitol
them in.
Capitol again?
I took the DATs and put them away in a thing and spoke to my sister and I said, these are the things here. Don't take them out until I tell you to. And I didn't take them home because I didn't want that risk. But and I got paid literally within 8 hours. They said we haven't got the money. Banks, can you? And you know stories in it. But I'll tell you something. Unlike that happened to me. That's actually it's pretty sad because it does happen a lot. I did a demo for a current company in town. for Nissan, did a spot for them. It was a cattle call, basically, and they'd gone through all their stable of writers and whatever, whatever, and they were all great writers, but they'd missed it, you know. So it was like 8 o'clock at night. Hey, do you want to do a demo? 30-second spot. They're looking for a theme for Nissan. Da-da. So I did it. Did the thing, called my mate in, played trumpet, you know, it was all nighter, big time. Sent it in, you know, literally at 10 a.m. in the morning, sent it to the guys, and they said, oh, great, yeah, we'll check it out, check it out. Got a call back 2 o'clock, and I was going away on vacation. Got a call back at 2 o'clock, said, no, sorry, didn't go, mate, sorry, you know, everybody's failed, don't worry. I said, okay, great, no worries, you know, and it was literally $500 demo fee. So I said, well, yeah, send me the $500, you know, what's it? And I was away on vacation, I was gone for about 2 weeks, and in about a week and a half, I was doing yoga, sitting in front of the TV, and I'm thinking, geez, that's strange. I thought that's my cue.
Oh, no.
And I turned around, I'm thinking, it's the Nissan spot. And I went and called the dude. I said, oh, the Nissan spot. He said, yeah, yeah, nothing happened. Sorry, mate. Sorry. I said, but I've just seen it on television. It's very scary.
Wow.
So I called the agency and got the video, and he said, oh, it must have been a mistake. Sorry.
Wow. And Were they going to credit the writing to somebody else as well and everything?
Oh, strangely enough.
They were?
Yep.
Wow, nasty stuff.
My mate that played the trumpet is a session player, right. And he saw me months after. He said, oh, we're just going down and cut a bunch more of those tracks of yours again. He said, they're doing it again. You went down there, no? I said, no.
Oh,
wow.
Hate to hear that.
Yeah. I actually have another one that I thought is where you were going, but check this out. We did a demo once. I forget what the product was for. Oh, no, it was a TV promo, but it was for a big show, and it was going to be a big deal. And they hadn't been able to find the music for a long time, and they gave us some other piece of music. They wanted our thing to kind of have the same energy as. It wasn't perfect, but it was good energy for the spot. And it was another one of those emergency nightmare things. We got in live band, did it for real, spent a ton of time, you know, worked all night, and we turned in the demo to them. And then it came back. They said, well, we don't like the direction. And so we kind of said, well, our first reaction was, we've had rejection before. That's fine. They just didn't like the direction. It turns out we found out through other people at the network, they never listened to our demo. Someone decided they didn't like the music they had sent us to do a sound alike of. So they never even put in our demo to listen to it.
Oh, gosh.
So we absolutely killed ourselves to get this thing done, and it never hit eardrums.
Well, you know, it's probably, a 40-minute piece of music, so it would take a long time to listen to it.
Right? Yeah. 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's amazing how clients, by the way, they think, like, if you do 30 seconds of music versus 10 minutes of music, that the 30-second thing should be, what, a 20th of the price,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And that's so not true. Right. I mean, the initial startup, whether you're doing a 2-second cue or a 2-minute cue, a lot of it's the same.
Yeah. Practice,
once you develop the idea, you can then restate it for a longer period of time. But that's another thing that clients totally don't get, is how to price out things like that.
You must have terrible stories, Mike.
Oh, man. I found a couple things with clients. Number one, the ones that are paying the least are usually the ones that are the most troublesome.
Always.
And, you know, working in post-production.
There's a reason they don't have budgets.
Yeah.
They don't deserve them.
Yeah, they don't deserve them, exactly.
I can remember a couple of them. One of them was this older gentleman who, you know, I pride myself when I work with a client to be really easy to work with, and I get along with everybody. And this is the only guy that I never got along with. And it's not like he didn't like me. He hated me. I mean, it was just a lot of animosity. And I think it was because he was an old school producer, and this was back about 8 years ago, when 9 years ago, when Pro Tools and mixing and post-production was still relatively new. And he just couldn't understand the thing of the whole non-linear, you could jump around. And so, like, I would be working on something, and he'd say, hey, can you lower the music a little bit here, or can you clean up the dialogue a little bit more? So I'd do it, and I'd be playing back, and I'd lower it and playing back and just working on this little section. And he'd stop me. He goes, no, play it with picture. I go, well, I'll play with picture. Let me just work on this, and I'll give you picture, you know. And it just freaked him out that I could play the audio and not chase picture at the same time, you know. He goes, well, how do I know when to stop you? And yeah. I go, well, let me just do it, and then I'll play it back for you. And he'd always use this term. He'd always say, you know, you got to put a face to it. you got to put a face to it, you know?
Because he couldn't imagine it without the pictures.
Exactly. So so it was like the buzzword, put a face to it. I need a face to it. You got to put a face to it. And it was like, it was just really, really bad. And at the end of the session, it was like, I think he was just ready to slug me because, you know, I didn't put a face to it all the time, you know? And it was just, and when I found out that he was just paying just dirt cheap rates, it was like, oh. Now I know why. And the other nightmare scenario is when you work with voiceover and it's somebody's friend. It's not like a voiceover person.
Being there.
Same with background singers.
Here's my brother. He's a real... Can we get him in to do something?
I was doing a car commercial, actually, and they brought in, like, the dealer's, you know, like, president or somebody. And they're like... They got him to read. Well, he has a nice voice. He sounds really lovely. You know, it's always they have a nice voice. Yeah. And so he gets in there and he walks in and his voice is kind of normal and it didn't sound bad. And it's like, okay, maybe.
Not as good as Andrew's.
That's right. It's not an Andrew voice.
Who
can be.
But what people don't realize is when you pay a voiceover person big bucks, and they do make big bucks, it's because they know how to read and they know how to
Actors.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they overact like crazy, but you don't notice. My daughter will say back the things, like she finds it really funny, all the announcers that come on to say the show is brought to you by, and she'll say it back just the way they said it, and she sounds ridiculous. But on TV, it sounds perfect.
Right. Yeah, it fits.
Exactly. You know? Well, I was working on this commercial, and the guy has a normal voice. I'm thinking, okay, if he can read, then we're there, and I can probably pull something out of it.
If he can read.
And he gets in there, and it was like, you know, Johnny Monotone. Welcome to, you know, just really static and just like this
and you know that can't be fixed.
Yeah.
Once you hear one sentence, you know, we're just not going to get this.
And then they start saying things like, well, can you make it sound a little better? Can you put a little, can you EQ it?
No, I can't.
Can you EQ feeling?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. There is no suck filter. But, those seem to be the classic, you know, if you have any combination, if you got low rates, you know, they're going to be a problem. If you've got, you know, inexperienced VO people, you know, they're going to be a problem. If you've got low rates and inexperienced VO.
Oof.
It's funny. We're not getting paid for this yet. We seem to put up a pretty good show, don't we?
Not really, do we?
I suppose not really.
Especially if we get to just complain about everybody else.
Yeah.
I'm doing the taxes. What, you're doing a crossword puzzle?
Yeah.
Now, we've had weeks of stories of like all the bad things that happened. And this isn't even something that happened to me, but it's something a friend of mine who's an engineer shared with me when he was coming up as an engineer. He was working in a studio in New York and they were doing jingles. And it was a cover of a song. I don't remember what song it was. It's not important, but it's some very well-known, like 50s or 60s pop song. And they've got this old guy who's a voice talent who's going to sing the song and he's supposed to be great. And he gets to the studio and he's all flustered and he's kind of running late and he gets out into the studio and he'd forgotten his teeth. And the song was full of S's and F's. And it was like Sylvester the Cat. There's a band and they didn't have time for anyone to go get his teeth for him. And so
that's great.
That's classic.
You know, since we did some stories on horror stories, do you guys have any, like, let's give the other side of the coin, sessions with clients that were just stand out, that were just really amazing?
Yeah, lots of times.
Yeah. A lot of times if you it's like anything else. If your expectations aren't that high, you're setting yourself up to be pleasantly surprised.
Right.
And we've a bunch of times hired musicians from – they were referred to us by friends who we really trust even though we had never heard them play. And there have been a few times where we've found some of the most amazing players who weren't even playing music for a living. You know, they were just doing it as a hobby, but it was a really passionate hobby. And, you know, if the state of the music industry was different, they would be doing it for a living because they're that good. But we've had a few times where people have referred us to rhythm sections where they were just amazing, just amazing. And so you can have happy accidents. You have to kind of give people a try. I've had probably more horror stories than happy accidents. And most of the time it's been with somebody referring a singer who you bring in sight unseen. And that's usually a nightmare.
I'll tell you.
We've had some good ones too.
The older we get, you know, obviously mostly I'm one of the older ones here, but you start to get like feelers after a couple of horror nightmares and a couple of all-nighters, you know, after a couple of years of those under your belt, you go, uh-oh, this one won't sing, next. And you don't bring them in the studio. You just like, there are any times my brother's coming in to sing, like, nope, can't do that. Union, sorry. Got to be union.
Yeah, there you go.
SAG, sorry.
No, we can tell in 5 seconds if the singer's going to be able to do it for the job. But we've had other times where there was a CBS job and they were looking for a voice to be their sort of voice of the CBS daytime soap operas, and he was going to do all the announcing, and they were having a hard time finding someone, and a friend of mine introduced us to a guy who was a singer, but he said, this guy has an amazing voice. I called him. I didn't get him. I got his voicemail, and he sounded amazing. So I left him a message. I said, call me back. He ended up calling me back and getting my voicemail, and he left a message. His message was so amazing sounding that I just called CBS and played them his answering machine message. And he got the gig. And he was the voice of the whole network for a year.
Wow. The moral of the story is get a good answering machine message.
Well, step one is
don't pick up the phone.
You know, we've said it so many times in the past, real talent will eventually get discovered as long as you don't give up on yourself before everybody else does.
Right.
So if you really do have that talent, you do have to get out there and try to do things, and you do have to show up at a bunch of places that aren't expecting you and do a bunch of demos and, you know, all the other things with producers who are leery about you. But if you really have the ability, they're not going to be leery for long, and you're going to get into the mainstream of the work. But, I mean, I'm still so cautious when somebody refers someone to us. Not that I wouldn't want to give the next great singer their big break,
right?
Because then you look like a hero for discovering the next big thing.
Right.
It's just not usually what happens.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, Andrew, do you have any stories of working with a client that's just like was just amazing? Or,
well, I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with some pretty amazing bands. So, I mean, every time you're in a room with a band that you've always liked and thought were amazing, and then you're actually in there while they're playing, and you see that they really are that good, and sometimes even better, because a lot of times, I mean, a lot of complaints people have about bands is, oh, the album doesn't capture what they do live. But even if someone screws up the album down the road, while they're tracking, they're doing it live, and you're in the room with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's happened a bunch of times. It's just incredible.
It's nothing like it.
How about you, Martin?
It's the same thing, really, what Andrew said. You know, there are moments I remember the good times much more than I do the bad times. So, you know, in general, right across, you'd have to say it's a very small amount of where you struggle. I think always the toughest time through the years was when you've recorded and you're mixing. And you can, and you may lose it in the mix, or you wait for that moment to come when you go, ah, it's happening. You know, all the ingredients are coming together. I found that struggling through the years because, you know, you do all the work and then you would have maybe an independent mixer come in, and because I always had a vision of how something should be mixed. That was always a tough spot, but it was always very sweet when you put your head over the edge and you go, now we're really speaking. And I think the most amazing feeling is when you're listening to a mix of what you spent a lot of time on,
right,
and you go, it's all really speaking like a really great picture. Right. It's really coming together, and there's nothing like thinking this is communicating, you know. But I think you know, I've had, you know, amazing moments in the studio, but I think the most powerful moments for me have been when the songs have been mixed and you're sat back and everybody's in the room and going like, yeah, this is really, because if something happens, but for me, when you write a song and you know the song in your own mind, you go, ah, this is speaking. You just feel something. It's a feel. And then usually you go through the process of recording it, playing it, thinking how to produce it. And then when it's finally being mixed and you're near to the next handshake to give it away to somebody, that's when I also find a great joy. Usually writing it, and usually when it's just about to be finished is where I get the buzz.
That's what, when I was a mixer, my business card used to say mixer and midwife.
It's a very true statement, that. It's a big thing.
It is,
you know,
true.
And you know, how many times have we been?
You do,
I was
need
in
it.
Lots of productions where I would be working, particularly with something like Earth, Wind and Fire, and they would bring in young mixers to try different tracks. And it's a struggle. You know, you know what it should be, and you've got a young guy there, and you're going like, oh, we've done 3 days, and we haven't turned the corner, you know.
Right.
That's a very, very hard,
spiritual
place to be. Yeah.
All the studio thing is personalities. You can get a young mixer, old mixer, anybody. Just somebody comes up and sticks the faders up in a certain way and maybe put a bit of juice on it, not much, and it's like, yeah, he's got the core right, or she's got the core right, or the players. That's all.
I think as an engineer, one thing that I always keep in mind is that, you know, ultimately what you're mixing or what you're doing is for whatever client is sitting behind me, you know. And I think I see the most successful, at least in post-production, a lot of the most successful mixers really have a good rapport with their clients and really know how to, you know, they keep in mind that this isn't their thing. This is the client's thing, and you're just sitting there and you're helping them get that vision out, you know. And
usually a lot of producers will find an engineer that they know understands them, and they move them around with them, you know. And that's a great vibe when a partnership starts like that.
And I think ego kills a lot of sessions. I've seen, you know, guys argue with directors on a music cue, and you know what? In reality, there's so much latitude as to where that music cue should be against that dialogue that, you know, keep them from getting in trouble, but give them what they want, because you're always going to walk away with a positive experience if they feel like they're not fighting you, you know. And then also the fact that every time they watch the movie, the DVD, the commercial, they'll, if you don't do it, they're going to remember you. It's just going to be a sore spot for them to look at every single time. One of the great things opportunities I've had with clients is I hate recording VO. I mean, it's just, for me, it's the most boringest thing in the world is to record VO.
Boringest. I mean, is that a word?
Yes, it is. It's a word now.
Yeah. To me, I used to think English class was the boringest.
It's the most boring.
Okay, thank you. This is a tough room.
I like boring. Wow, that's why I'm an engineer. Anyhow. I've had some really terrific opportunities working with two people in that come to mind. Are one was William Shatner. I did a National Geographic piece with William Shatner, and that guy was just a pro. He was just so good, and he was just exactly how you would imagine him being. He was like that. It was a thrill. It was one of those moments where you just get the hair on the back of your neck kind of stands up. It's William Shatner. And then the other one was Angela Lansbury, because she was just so sweet and she was just so nice. And
I bet.
And working good with projects like that, it's kind of helps overcome the bad times.
Definitely.
I'm going to segue into, with clients in general, do you guys have really quick one or two words of advice working with clients to keep harmony in your session? What would you say would be the most important thing, Rob, that you should pay attention to when you're working
with clients? I think the main thing is you always have to make a client feel like you're trying all their ideas, even if they may seem ridiculous, because number one, they may be ridiculous, in which case they're going to realize it's ridiculous once they hear it. But sometimes they're just thinking of something a different way than you are, and their idea may be valid, because as much as you've been thinking about this spot, they've probably been thinking about it more, because their job's on the line. You know, this is a gig that's coming and going for you, but a lot of these people's careers may rest on what they're doing. So I learned a long time ago to always try their idea, no matter how crazy it sounds, or at least make the attempt to try their idea. And most of the time, if it turns out to be a bad idea, it'll go away. And if it turns out to be a good idea, you look like the hero anyway.
Andrew, do you have any one or two sentences?
Well, the combination of what you said before and what Rob just said, I mean, especially in music, the worst thing you can do as an engineer is to think that you're making your record. You are never making your record. Yeah. You're always making the artist's record and, in some sense, the producer's record. And that's it. And with what Rob said, try it, because you may learn something.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, if you listen to some of the balances on some of the albums that people think are real classics, like the Hendrix records, there's so much crazy stuff going on in those records, and that's what makes it work. So don't think you know. Always try it, and even if it doesn't stick, you'll learn something for later.
And if it sounds good, you get the credit anyway. It's like it's a win-win.
Bobby, have any advice for working with clients?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, Rob, you both guys are exactly right. I think maybe I'll just add, be honest. Definitely be honest when it comes to, I'm talking from a music mixing point of view, and obviously I should talk about more the TV thing, but yeah, I think it's certainly good to be honest when people ask you for their input, you know, not to hurt in any way, but I think definitely if you're in the team and you're on the team, and they're asking for input, don't be a pandering inputter.
Right. Yeah, have an opinion.
Be honest, exactly. 100%. I mean, that's 99% of the time. You've got to be careful of that. Certainly, you don't go and blurt it out. But
Martin, any?
I come at it a little bit different because I'm a songwriter, so right. I'm not really involved so much with the business side of it or people, you know, telling me what to do in a way. I'm usually collaborating with people or other writers. So for me, it was always, get on with the person you're working with, you know, be your relationship's really important. So if I was having to write with someone, they had to trust me, get into me. I had to understand them and learn each other's strengths, but be easy to get on with. And open, as everybody has said, to another person's point of view.
Right.
That's really, really important. And another strange thing to say is laughter. You know, when you get in a room with somebody that's new, in any part of it, people like to relax and they like to have a giggle, usually.
Right.
And that can break the ice.
I think one thing that I want to add is that, to follow up what you were saying, Martin, is just be nice. You know, mm-hmm. when they walk
True.
In, just don't turn your back and start working. You know, ask them how their day is or just start a conversation because people are going to remember the experience, believe it or not, even more so than the product. If they know, hey, every time I go work with this guy, have a great time and I get along, we laugh, you know, that's going
to
do a lot.
It's important to be intense about the work, but you know, at first, but being pliable and just letting, because everybody's all finding their way when they first go into a project. And so, as you say, kindness, I know it sounds very antiquated, but it's a big deal.
No, it's really going to help your reputation. And ultimately, it's going to help you get employed. The other thing too is, Bobby, what you were saying is, especially in post-production, is have an opinion, because when they, if they ask you, you be honest and you tell them, because they're looking for you and you need to be the rock because it's going to make them feel better. Even if the only thing you say is, what you're doing is great or I agree with it.
Well, I used to ask, talking from a mixing standpoint, but I used to sometimes sit back and go, you can't see that here with the wood for the trees anymore after a long day, and you go, man, let me just check this out. And you sit at the back and you ask, the assistant, say, hey, I think that snare drum's sitting there nicely. What do you reckon? And if you are, that's an example where I would ask somebody something, and if they ask
this
you.
This is a really good point that Bobby's using as well. It's very good to make everybody feel they're part of a team.
That's right. True.
And once they all feel they're involved, even if it's the T-boy or something, there's a really great feeling in the room. And some great things can happen when everybody feels they're in the same team, in the same pocket.
When there's
alienation, like the producer's not linked to the mixer and everybody's scared to talk, it's not a great vibe for the air. Right. So building a team atmosphere is really important.
I agree.
Don't let the producer feel like he woke you up to ask you the question. You know, a lot of times, especially on a long film mix or something,
it's
easy to kind of fall apart. Exactly.
Thanks, Rob. You woke me up there for a second.
Good for that.
All right. Well, hey, I'll tell you what.
And good coffee, too.
That's good.
Very good idea.
Hey, well, that was great talking about clients. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about EQ, frequencies, and a bunch of other stuff. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and we're here with everybody. And yes, everybody is still here. No one's left early. They wanted to, but they haven't left early.
Well, you lost the door from the outside. Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to talk a little bit, guys, really quick about EQ. We did Gear 101 about 10 podcasts ago. We talked about mic pre's and we talked about compression. And I wanted to talk about EQ a little bit because EQ is one of those things that can help you out if you know how to use it. But it can also just really destroy things really fast. And I wanted to go to – let's start with Bobby. Why don't you tell us a little bit about EQs and the different types of EQs?
Okay. From a 101 basis, just for people that don't know, I'm sure they do, EQ means equalizer. Bit of history. It came into evolution because people were recording on strange recording platforms like metal cylinders and things like that. So they had to find a way of getting the sound off of it to sound like it sounded when it was recorded to it. So they started making these EQs. An EQ, what an equalizer really is, in a nutshell, is a a bunch of amplifiers with certain frequencies. So you could turn the volume up of just the high frequencies or down of just the high frequencies or up or down of any other frequencies in it. And typical EQs in the old days was just two band or you know, a typical EQ would be a tone knob on an amplifier would be a, turn it to the right, get more treble or more mid-rangey treble, turn it down, you get less. And then that was basically it. So that's in a nutshell what equalizers are, EQs. But as we move on, equalizers become very popular in recording everything. There's a couple of schools of thought with equalizers. I subscribe to both of them. I think some people think you shouldn't use an equalizer. You should only use it as subtractive, you know, to cut frequencies. Some right. people think you shouldn't use your equalizers because if you use an equalizer, you've got the microphone in the wrong spot. And I kind of think you should just use equalizer and use your ears. And if you like it, EQ it. And if you don't, whatever. But there are different kinds of equalizers. Basic equalizer, as I said, they've all got volume controls on them of different frequencies. They have the original EQ, equalizers originally were made for tape machines. Well, a lot of them were made for tape machines and recording voices for radio and whatever. And lots of those equalizers were very limited. They just had one or two bands. The advantage of using a fewer band equalizer is that certainly from an analog, and I'm talking from analog equalizers first, so I can get into digital later, but an analog equalizer has a lot, if it has a lot of frequencies in it, like three or four or seven or whatever, the more frequencies you have the ability to cut and boost, if you cut or boost a frequency, the frequencies, one frequency, the frequency on either side of it changes in amplitude. And also you start to get phase shifting. So it can color the sound in more ways than you would intellectually imagine. Instead of just reducing the volume of, say, 1K, you will also start reducing the volume of 2K and 500 hertz, 2K, 1,000 hertz cycles I'm talking about, and 2,000 cycles. And that depends on the wideness of the EQ. And EQ's terminology, wideness, is sometimes called the bell or the Q or the resonance, right. either one of those. And that just really says how narrow the EQ band is that is boosting. But, you know, we'll all chip in here.
Well, let's talk. Andrew, why don't you tell us about a couple different types of EQ, like a graphic and a parametric? And
The two main kinds of EQ in terms of I bought a box and it's an equalizer would be a graphic, which is the one that has lots of sliders, and then a parametric EQ. And the difference is a graphic EQ, let's say, has 10 sliders in it. And what they've done is they've taken the frequency band that people hear, sort of from 20 hertz up to 20,000 hertz, split it into equal chunks based on octaves. So it's a logarithmic progression. It's not like every 100 hertz they put a band. But anyway, split it up into 10 bands, and then for each one of those, you can either boost or cut that frequency. And as Bobby said, you're actually cutting a range of frequencies, but you're centered at the frequency that's labeled on that slider. Then the other type of an equalizer in general is a parametric equalizer, where you've got three knobs that go together to give you an equalization effect, one of which is how much are you going to cut and boost. The other knob is what's the center frequency of the range of frequencies you're going to cut and boost. And then the third knob is the Q, which would be how wide is this range of frequencies. And both have their advantages, and I use both all the time. Now, there's another kind of equalizer, which is usually included either on the top and bottom bands of a graphic equalizer or the top and bottom bands of a parametric, which are shelving equalizers, where instead of having a center frequency and then you equalize the frequencies around them, it's everything from this frequency up or everything from this frequency down. And usually a parametric equalizer will actually have a combination of parametric bands in the mid-range and then shelving bands on the top and bottom. And then you may also have filters, which aren't equalizers in the sense that you can boost or cut, but they will just get rid of frequencies below a certain frequency or above. So a combination of all of those different types of equalization circuits right. can go together to give you one equalizer, or a graphic EQ is usually all fixed bandwidth filters that you boost or cut, and it splits the bandwidth into either 10 spots, 20 spots, 30. Usually if you're EQing the main speakers in a room or a PA system, you'll have 30 of those bands on a graphic.
Now, let me start off, and I'm going to open this up to everybody, but it seems like EQing if you could master EQing, or at least get a really firm grip of understanding of EQing, you're going to really be able to solve a lot of your problems that come up during a mix, because you'll be able to dig things out and you'll be able to add some clarity when you need to add some clarity or fix some problems. Do you guys have, any one of you, have a specific game plan when it comes to EQing when you first start a project?
You know what, I'll actually say even before you start the project, but when you first start to work in a room, if you've set up your own room or you're working someplace else, it's a very dangerous thing to start EQing things in a room that you don't understand it sounds like. So the first thing you need to do on any speaker system, whether it's your own or somebody else's, is listen to some music that you're familiar with, how it's supposed to sound, so that you can learn the way that room reproduces that music. Because you might be in a room that doesn't have a lot of high end to it, and you're going to be doing a mix, boosting a bunch of treble and other high frequencies, and all of a sudden you're going to play it back someplace else, and people's eyeglasses are going to shatter because you put so much high frequency on the thing. You have to know the room you're in. And the easiest way that I've done it, and I've seen other engineers do it, is just bring in some of your favorite CDs and have a listen and just see.
And yeah, and you don't necessarily have to change how the room sounds unless it's horrendous, but your brain will hear the things you're used to, and you get used to the way they sound in that room. Yeah. And hopefully, without having to be too conscious of it, you'll adjust yourself so that you realize, well, that's what sounds good in this room.
And you need to do that before you even start working, because you just can't trust what you're working on until you know how that room relates to the rest of the world.
Otherwise, a lot of times you'll start working and get it sounding great, and then you put in something that you like. Right. You go, man, well, I used to like that, but it sounds like crap. Like, well, no. The room actually sounds different, and you've shifted your perspective of what is good.
That happens all the time.
Well, I'll tell you, when we were putting together Martin's studio, we dealt with the room acoustics a lot. So that you could start mixing, and you, Martin, you do a really great job with your mixes, and I know your approach to EQ is not basic, but it's definitely.
I would say basic.
Well, I was going to say precise.
Primitive is another good word.
But you couldn't have done that unless you worked on your room.
Yeah, I mean, it was the same as really what Rob was saying. You know, I knew my analog room very well, and I'd got used to it, and there were some CDs that I really knew in different formats. So you understood what it was like in the car, you understood what it was like on the radio, and I think that's a really good thing, to get a perspective of very different speakers, different situations, and I knew that pretty well. So when I went into the digital room, which was really my living room, which was converted, I had the help of Bobby and yourself to get it into a certain place. And even now, I'm still not as acquainted to that room, and it's a harder room to monitor on than the older room was. I was very used to a very dead room, and this is a little more live. But we mentioned this in an earlier podcast. I use a lot of headphone mixes now. I mix a great deal between the two worlds. I do what Bobby says. I stand back, walk outside, listen to the music next door, have a cup of tea, come back in again, put the headphones on, listen to it really there.
Oh, I said drive down the road and listen to it. Play it at home and then drive off.
Yeah. then I've been really making a mistake. But, you know, I come again, you know, from a songwriter point of view. So to me, it's more emotional than anything else. Right. You know, I don't really look at it technically. I just listen to it. I'm a great fan of bass, being a bass player. I believe that the warmer elements of music, touch the soul more. And in the music I write, I tend to lean much more towards the bottom half of music, because I think it shows, it makes me feel more depth. Obviously, in my early years, when I used to work with Mutt Lange, it was very much, you know, the more bright you could make things, right, the more commercial and the more impact it gave. And I think there's a reality to that. I really do. But personally, you know, over the years, again, what Bobby mentioned, you sort of grow into it. And I tend to look for the warmth in even an acoustic guitar or a vocal. I find it easier to record warm and then brighten up.
Right.
I find it harder to start in a bright place and pull back. Something gets lost in that. I'd sooner build from the lake and go up towards the sun, really, that way.
So now we have our room, we know our room, and we're about to start a mix, and we've tracked and we've used great mics, and we're ready to roll. Andrew, do you have a specific plan, a set of frequencies you start looking at? Do you know, like, wow, I know we're going to start having some problems here, or do you just...
No, I mean, there's never an overall plan, because you don't know what you've got coming. But, right. I mean, the two things that I think are really important that are missed by a lot of people, especially who don't get to record a lot, and they just end up either with programming or mixing, so they're not dealing acoustically with the sound, is the high-pass filter is the least used and should be the most used thing on any equalizer. Because if you're recording an acoustic guitar, the warmth that we're talking about is probably in the 100 hertz and up range.
Yeah, it's not 40 hertz.
But there's probably a bunch of stuff going on at 40 hertz, which you don't even really hear. And if you get rid of it, won't annoy you at all. It's not going to make the guitar sound smaller. But what it does is it screws up the kick drum and the bass. And even on the kick drum, a lot of times I will cut at 40 hertz and boost at 60 hertz. So that there's nothing below 40. I mean, you know, no high-pass filter actually cuts everything off. There's a slope to it.
Right.
But you get rid of, because that's the sort of thing, there's so much energy in the low frequencies that when you start putting a limiter across your mix, if you've left all of this crazy air conditioner rumble and microphone rumble and proximity effect on vocals and things in every individual track, it will add up to the point where your mix can be about half as loud as it can. And I don't mean like loud because that's what it needs to be, but you've got no room for any of the other frequencies because that takes up so much energy. The other thing is, especially with plugins, you now, it used to be you just get some knobs, you know, and you start cranking EQ and you listen and that's all you can do. And now you get this great readout. You get the frequency response of what the EQ is actually doing. So you can see the effect of the cue when you tighten that up. Or if you don't tighten it up and you boost at 1K, you see how you're affecting this huge wide range. And a lot of people will never touch the cue control on a parametric EQ. Because generally there's this one, which is a spread of so many dB per octave around your middle frequency. And that's nice if you're doing a little bit. But if you start cranking that EQ and you don't tighten down the Q of that band, you're affecting everything. You're turning up everything. And the phase shift gets weird and all kinds of stuff happens. So mess with all of the controls on the EQ and see if you really need to be EQing this wide swath of sound, you know?
That's a great idea. You know, the low-pass filter, too, though, can really be your best friend if you want to get rid of a lot of that upper high-end air and hiss on stuff that you just don't need, you know? You don't need
it. Yeah, the simplest noise reduction on a low thing.
Yeah, it's to kill the highs. I will say also, if you have a final two-track master of something and you're trying to get the volume of it up, a lot of times, like if something was mixed in a room without a sub, if you just put a high-pass filter and get rid of the real low frequencies, all of a sudden you're going to be able to make the thing much louder as opposed to what a lot of people do, like run it through an L2 or something to limit the heck out of it.
But, and this is 30 hertz and below we're talking about.
Yeah, well, you're not
going to
hear it anyway.
Hertz.
Well, we're in digital world, too. And at 20, we got a brick wall filter at 20 hertz. I mean, it starts rolling off big time, a lot of the digital stuff. So it doesn't even start – it starts to get real funky down there.
So you're not going to damage the music at all. You're going to help it by getting rid of some of the real low stuff. And you'll be able to get it louder and sounding good without having to limit it to death.
I don't have a plan, as Andrew's. I just sit down and you never know what's coming at you, so you don't know. I don't say, oh, this is going to be like this. But there's a couple of styles of music that I sometimes end up mixing: R&B, dance, hip hop, you know, club oriented low frequency stuff. I end up shaving all the low frequencies off of nearly everything, actually literally nearly everything, and even like the 909s, you know, if you're doing the house stuff. The 909 is like obviously it's an old 909 drum box. It's a synthesizer bass drum, and it's got a lot of noise. It's a horrible sounding bass drum, really,
right?
But you squash the hell out of it, you know, compress quite a bit and boost, exactly, do the sort of cut and boost sort of thing as Andrew mentioned. And I'll add to that a very popular, famous EQ, in fact, it's called EQP1A, made by Pultec many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a tube misunderstood. It's actually a passive EQ but with a tube amplifier in it to make up the gain once you've cut or boosted the frequencies of it. But the nice thing about this EQ is that it has two knobs. Well, it has two frequencies. You can cut and boost the high and or low frequencies, and they're selectable, 20, 30, 60, can't remember the frequencies, but anyway, about four knobs. But the nice thing is you can actually cut and boost the same frequency, and you think, that's kind of strange, why would you want to do that? And the reason why you'd want to do it is exactly as what Andrew's saying. Sometimes you want to boost like a low frequency and then cut right below it.
Right.
So you actually just say, no, I just want this part to be low and I don't want to suck up all the noise underneath it, all the lows underneath it, so you shave it off. With the digital stuff, it's much easier to do. Digital EQs, all the brick wall stuff, you can actually literally put like a 46, 48 dB wall cut off at the back of it. But it will make your mixes sound a lot better if you actually, all the stuff that you don't need low frequency on, get rid of it. 100%.
One of the things that...
Except the kick drum.
Yeah, right. One of the things that's fresh in my mind, because I actually just did a bunch of presets for a big plug-in company. One of the things that I find hilarious is that people use EQ presets in plug-ins. And there are a bunch of manufacturers that will even boast about their plug-in or their EQ presets. And to me, an EQ preset is such a bizarre thing. Like a preset called Vocal. Yeah, you know
what's coming in.
Yeah,
and it's like looking at that readout of the EQ, thinking, "Well, that's what I'm getting." It's like, no, that's how you're affecting what goes in. But just because you crank a bunch of 200 hertz, if there isn't any, there still isn't any.
Right.
But the thing is, there'll be a preset called kick drum in an EQ, as if there's only one kind of kick drum. It's just a ridiculous thing, and
well,
I think in a lot of ways
that one works.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, okay. That one's good.
Okay. The one called cello.
No, that's crazy.
Presets I ever use in the preset world is like if I need like a telephone EQ quickly.
Yeah,
like,
sure, but that's
bang.
An effect.
It's like, yeah, because it's got it all like nicely dialed off the top and the bottom and compressed out of it. Like,
But people need to be wary of using EQs or using presets for things like that, like EQs and compressors and limiters and all those things, because there's no two projects that are the same. There's no two recorded signals that are the same, and it's kind of crazy to think you can just call up a preset and it's going to fix your voice.
I will say that presets on EQs are a great place to learn where the action is.
You absolutely, they're a good starting point, and they're also good if you're working on a project where you might be going between different scenes in a movie. It's great to be able to store your own presets for different locations. That's great. But the idea of a preset where, you know, I have no idea how to record a snare, but there's this preset called snare, so that'll probably work.
Okay, now let me ask you guys, we'll pull this out to the whole panel. Tell me some dangerous frequencies that if you're just starting off and you want to EQ or where people make a lot of mistakes. Do you know any particular frequencies you just want to stay away from?
Can I add just before, I won't specifically answer this question unless you want me to, but I'll just say, one danger with EQing generally, as for everybody to know, is that you end up, when you start EQing, you generally will end up adding too much if you're trying to boost.
Right.
And you can end up cutting most probably too much. It's really important to, when you turn a knob on an EQ, there's two things going on. If you have a knob to turn, that is, but if you're moving a mouse, it's a different story, I suppose. But, when you turn a knob on an EQ, you're expecting to hear a change, and sometimes you do. You don't hear as much of a change as you actually are affecting the thing. So you end up boosting more, really a lot more than you really need to. And you go, oh, yeah, that's much better. And you actually sit back. You really need to get your ears to like settle down and relax and go, man, that is really bright.
If you're not fixing a problem, if you're boosting a lot, then you probably need to turn the thing up and then EQ less.
Right.
I think another thing is to, you know, look at all the variables it's going to be heard on. So, you know, you're going to be going down to a CD or you're going down to a DAT, and you're going to listen to it on a car, and you're going to listen to it on different speakers. So, you know, that's another thing you have to be aware of when you're EQing, that you're in a way you're trying to find as well a kind of middle ground that is going to translate on a lot of different variables, you know.
I think people need to stay away from playing too much around the Ks, the 1K, the 2K. I mean, that's just, those are really dangerous frequencies for vocals because you can turn it into a knife to, they'll cut you right
now. Well, your ear is much more sensitive at 3.5K than it is anywhere else. So you're already turning that up, and it's also a little bit lower than that is where if you've got a speaker with two drivers, a woofer and a tweeter, that's the crossover point. So that's always going to sound weird in the speaker, and it's going to sound different on every speaker.
I just think that's a good place for people to caution.
In fact, you learn a lot from when you EQ by listening on different speakers after you've done it.
Yeah.
Because then you start to just get an overall feel like you would with an instrument. Like going, you know, if I play this on, you know, NS10s and I play this on Tannoys, it's the same EQ, it does sound different, you know. So you sort of learn as you listen on different formats as well where your area of attack is, you know.
I can suggest that something I did practice when I was a kid trying to be a mixer, I would set up a set of Auratones, which is a single, very small 8-inch speaker or 6-inch speaker, and it's not bi-amped, it's just a single speaker, so it's got one cone and comes out of, has no crossover. And I'd use a set of old NS10s or a set of EVs or a set of JBLs, which has 2 or 3 way, and then a big set of Westlakes or something in the room. And I would EQ, but also I would say that when you're EQing, be careful of your volume, your monitor volume, because you can definitely confuse your ear so badly that you can actually take a good hour out of your day because your ear's like, just, I can't tell what's going on anymore. I've blown out 2K in my ear.
Yeah, that's true.
You really need it. But either way, so a really good practice, and I really suggest it for everyone. You can use headphones as well, but get 3 of your favorite speakers that are very different, meaning a single cone, a double cone, a 3-way, whatever it is, bi-amp, whatever it is. Or even your Mac laptop speakers, EQ a mix. Just take a stereo mix and say, I want to make this sound like this on all these speakers. And EQ it on one set of speakers first and then listen to them all on all 3 of them. It will take about 4 hours to do because your ear gets confused. And then do the same on the next set of speakers and listen to them all and do that and do them all. What it actually doing is you're training your ear to understand that when you EQ, you have to EQ. You have to realize that what you're listening to, the frequency response of the speaker will give you a false reading, exactly what Andrew's kicking at. If you, for example, had your Mac laptop speakers on and you're mixing a mix on there, you're like, oh, I can't hear the kick drum.
Right.
Let's add a couple of 100 hertz. Oh, there you go. Let's put 60 dB at 100 hertz. And the portal of the speakers go, and you think, oh, that sounds killer. And you put it on your JBL set or your you know, whatever, and it'll take the low frequency out. So try that. It's really very interesting. And where I'm getting with this is that you'll actually find the most useful range of frequencies in a mix is truly high, like 250 hertz to barely 3.5K. If you master those frequencies, yeah, it will sound good balance-wise, I'm talking. I'm not saying there's not important frequencies above or below that. But if you master the balance of your instruments in that frequency range, you've got a pretty good balance. The balance will live pretty well on a lot of different styles of speakers, including the good ones and the bad ones.
Well, a way to expand on that, too, is it's a really good idea if you're getting your music out to the masses to check. If you don't mix with a subwoofer, at least check it with a subwoofer to make sure you're not doing any crazy stuff down there. I actually, if you have a really good pair of speakers and they're set up right and you're really used to how they sound, a sub may not be necessary for your work, but if someone's bringing you tracks, there's a possibility that there's some, you know, 10K bizarre noise that got generated at some point that you have no idea is even there until it's too late. It's a good idea to just be able to check it with
a
sub.
I've never heard 10K in my life, have you?
Yeah, you'd feel
what's
it.
That,
but,
what's that?
But you don't actually use a subwoofer for most of your...
No, but my main speakers are Tannoy's, and they're not that big, but I can actually see when there are low frequency problems because they're not the tightest woofers, for they move a lot. And so when
don't
I
try
see
that at home, Andrew is very experienced.
I go find the problem and make them stop moving. And NS10s are the same way. If they're bottoming out, there's too much low end.
I will say too that when you're working on an overall master, when you're working on your overall mix, you can get a lot of clarity by looking at the low mids and not being afraid to drop out some of the low mids on some of your stuff because they tend to, you know, get squished together and it can really muddy, just make it muddy and just not have.
I mean, realize what frequencies are important for each instrument.
Yeah.
You don't need low end coming out of an acoustic guitar or the overheads on the drum kit necessarily. A lot of people won't bother getting rid of the low frequencies in the mics they're trying to get the cymbals out of. But what you've got is a lot of out-of-phase kick drum and bass leakage from the amp that was in the next room, and you don't need that on those.
And
tracks.
It doesn't even have to be like the super low stuff. Like if you cut like 450 to 500, if you cut that a little bit, you'd be amazed how all of a sudden you got a little bit of room for things to breathe around it, and it's just not colliding right there.
You can, I mean, you got to use your. I mean, there's no law. I mean, there is rules you can go by, but you've got to use your ears. You've got to be able to learn to listen. That's really the key, and learn to know when you're getting confused, and learn to know, oh, yeah, this doesn't sound as bright as I thought it was, or it is bright, or whatever. You really got to learn, and I suggest for anybody who's just starting off, don't get into the nitty gritties of 20-band EQs and just get a nice tone EQ, like 3-band EQ or 4-band EQ at the most, and don't switch the Q on to narrow. Make it nice and broad so you, hey, okay, I'm adding treble, you know, because when you start getting narrow Qs going on, I'm not saying don't use them, because I use them all the time, and I use two or three of them and put them out of phase and do tricks. We all do that. But I'm saying when you're learning, just, you know, just say, okay, let me put a shelf. Let me put a bit of top on 2K. You know, let's add 2 dB, 3 dB. Any more than that, you know, you really do – you are altering the sound so much that you're confusing yourself. Not to say it's not a good idea, but
– Well, and also, if you're serious about being an engineer, you need to also do some ear training. Like we talked about bass and drums. You got to go listen to great bass players and great drummers. You need to spend some time with an oscillator and say, I know kind of how high 400 hertz is. Most people, if they had to say, where's 800 hertz, they'd be completely wrong.
Right.
They'd think it was much lower than it is. Yeah. And 6K, people think that's either way down in the 1K range, or they think it's up in the 10K range. Nobody knows where 6K is. But you'll gladly grab an EQ and start EQing 6K.
Right.
But you should know what it is, because sometimes you're actually EQing the harmonics and not the fundamental problem you're trying to fix, because you're in the heat of it and you've got musicians there, you're trying to finish a mix. But, you know, spend some time, be a geek, and get an oscillator and, like, do some – test yourself.
And Graphic Equalizer is excellent for that.
Yeah.
A 31 band, you know, the old Clark Techniques, the old Whites, they were great. They're really great. Got little dials. You go, okay, well, that's 10K. Oh, okay.
Of course, I think everybody knows where 1K tone is, because you used to hear that.
Yeah, but now you never do. You know, it's like nanowebers per meter now. Nobody knows what you're talking about.
Well, hey, listen. Reproduce a test tape, catalog number 724.
Before we go,
playback, 1 kHz.
We're running out of time. Let's talk about some hardware, specific hardware. Tell me some of your favorite EQs.
Well, I've got tons of them. I love a lot of different EQs.
Sure.
Pultex, I love Pultex. I love 8200s, GML, George Massenburg. I like some of the old LTEC EQs. I like some of the real old, spanky old all bands, the old cheap ones. I like Neves. I like a lot of the Neves. I like the Focusrite. I mean, there's a ton of them.
Martin?
Yeah, I just got my three favorites, really, at home. Yeah, I've got the Massenburg. I've got a couple of panels of Neve, very old Neves.
1073s you got?
Yeah, that were dug out of an old board. I've also got I said Massenburg, didn't I?
Yeah.
I said Neve. I used to enjoy working on my old board, my old Soundcraft.
Yeah.
Because it was pretty brutal and pretty straightforward. A nice middle tone, which I don't go looking for. And I found that a lot on the Soundcraft that used to help out. And recently with the, SSL, that I put in with
the 4000 series, yeah.
Which was just, you know, software. And I found that, and Bobby checked it out, it was pretty good. But I hang around a great deal with, basically the Massenburg and the Neve.
Great. Rob?
I would have to say, if I was going to pick three, I'd the ones I've been playing with and liking the most now are ones I acquired the most recently, but the API 550A.
That's a great.
And the plug-in version of it is really good, too. I actually have the hardware and the plug-in sitting right next to each other, and I've used both. And there are differences, but it's a pretty amazing simulation, and I wasn't going to go out and buy 100, you know, 550As, so it's nice to have the plug-in. I like that. I like the GML, the Massenburg, for super clean stuff. And I have to say, for recording instruments, I've been using the Chandler Germanium tone control, which Andrew actually hit me to, and that thing is just amazing. It's just this make it sound better box. You know, for recording guitar and stuff, you take a tone you like and you run it through that, and it kind of operates like a simple tone control. Like some of the old style EQs Bobby was talking about, but it just makes things sound better. It's really cool.
Well, I got a console full of Neves. Obviously, I like Neves. I love the API stuff. But the Chandler stuff, if you're looking for new things, he makes a whole range. And they're all based on old things. There's a Neve style, a Pultec style. The Germanium, he's starting to branch out.
Right.
He also copies a lot of the EMI stuff, which nobody has except EMI Studios, which at this point it's Abbey Road, and half of it doesn't work, and the other half they're not letting you rent. So there's some great EQs that Chandler's putting out now. I mean, they're tons, and they're all different. I mean, and even with the plugins, they're all different. You need to just try lots of different EQs.
You can also play around. You'd be surprised for gimmick EQs. I'm not saying about pristine stuff, but even so, sometimes you want to get a fun sound, and you'll be surprised at like some DJ EQs.
Oh,
and
definitely.
I use
definitely.
Newmark and stuff like that. It's amazing.
Yeah, because they're brutal, which is great.
Yeah, it is.
And especially, it's analog, too. A lot of them are analog, and they're great.
Oh, I've used, I actually have a Newmark DJ mixer that I've used for brutal stuff.
Oh, that's it's beautiful.
Deadly, that thing.
My two favorites is, I'm a Waves plugin. I like any of the Q, the Q10. You know, it's like that meat and potato EQ.
Yeah, you know what? And mixing a film, that Q4, Q5, whatever is in that range is amazing.
Full Q.
I can usually get what I need on that when I'm mixing in Pro Tools on the Q10. It's just a lot of bands. You can do all kinds of stuff. You can change the Q. It's just a really good EQ.
And it's pretty efficient, so you can have a lot of them.
Yeah. And then the other one is I love the 560. The API 560 to me is just the funnest
EQ.
Yeah, it's the graphic, and it's just so easy. It's so musical. The way they have the bands, it's just, it's really easy just to get a great tone by just experimenting. You know, if you just want to go and raise things and lower things,
and it also does things that no other graphic does, as far as I know, because the Q changes depending on how much you boost or cut to get out of other bands' ways. If you cut or boost more, the cue gets tighter.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's really good.
CAD console used to do that. I used to like that about it.
If you want
to
take your loop and you run it out into a like a pair of 560s, and you can just do things to your drum loops that it can make them sound like brand new loops, because it really, either you can pull out a kick drum or you can make the snare a little snappier. So it's really great.
Don't forget
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to give an honorable mention to the Sony Oxford EQ, too. That's one of our go-to.
Worthy, very worthy.
That's not a bad one either.
And not forgetting gates, noise gates. The old analog noise gates used to have, like, a key, listen, the front end on
great
those EQs.
Filters. Yeah.
Great filters. That's what you use those. You put them in listen and...
Well, gang, that was a great discussion on EQs, and I just want to, you know, I really want to encourage people out there, if you, you know, A, don't be afraid of EQs, and the guys are really giving some great advice for where to start and how to craft your music and how to really use the EQs to really take your music to the next level. Before we go, Rob, are you working on anything that...
I certainly am, which is why I was late today, but... I'm close to being able to talk about it. It's the same thing I've been saying I'm going to be able to talk about soon, but I think I may be one podcast away from being able to talk about
it. Wow, I'm looking forward to that.
But it's exhausting, I'll tell you that.
Andrew, are you working?
But an album I mixed a few months ago actually just came out.
Oh, great.
This guy, Cass McCombs, really talented singer, songwriter. It's on Domino, so I highly recommend everyone check that out. A very odd album and the most reverb I've ever used. But it's really good.
Wait, what's it called?
Cass McCombs is the name of the guy, and the album is called Dropping the Writ.
All right.
An English law reference.
Writ,
Bobby, you...
Doing anything? I'm actually cut a band last week. It's not just trio. It's actually a jazz band, six-piece. And I've been mixing this week. And that's it. And my music library got signed to a deal, as I said, and actually signing on Friday. Ta-da.
Great.
I'll be drunk on Monday.
Yay!
And broke on Tuesday.
Really? I'm broke now, hey.
I'm Pagey Boy. I know you've been doing some writing and some other things.
Yeah, I'm writing. I'm feeling very creative, so I run into the room and pick up the guitar and pick up the cassette player and just write. So I'm doing that, and Bobby helped me out yesterday with putting...
I hope I did.
Yes, you did. The Grace Note details for my new record, and my real website is, and it's very, very last stages now. And you're helping me with some of the advertisements that are about to go on the MySpace page. So very busy, creative, very happy. And, I'm looking forward to the coming up to Christmas.
You know, one thing I want to mention, Paige, about your album is, you know, I've had the privilege of seeing the whole process go through, and it's a lot bigger than I ever thought. The whole process of the release and all the prep
work. It's a lot more. It's an interesting thing you say that, because there might be some people listening to this that I said September the record would be out. But because it's my own label, it's just my friends helping me and my manager involved, it's been more than I thought. Very enjoyable, because you have to step back and say, I'm not going to stress out about this. Let's get this permit for that. Let's get that permit for that. I've been very fortunate with people like Bobby and yourself, and that have been there to guide me. But it's a little more than we thought. But, you know, it's different as well because we are dealing with the internet world. And everything, it takes a little bit longer because it's a small crew doing it. But ultimately, when it is a small crew doing it, you feel more rewarded, you know. And the fans have been great, you know. This MySpace thing has been really terrific. The people that have been involved, like Roy Ashen, who's helping me with the website, they've been very much into it. And, you know, very encouraging. So it's in a way, I would find this more rewarding than having my record come out on time with a major label and it be very clinical. This has been more organic, and you know, it's a good time because I'm learning as I go, and it's my own label. So I'm excited.
Well, the one thing I've noticed too is anything that comes out or anything that you're going to put out, it seems, since it's your own project,
sure,
you definitely just want the best, and you,
yeah,
can just make sure it comes out that way. It's not like you have a label saying, okay, you know,
yeah,
we're going to, you know, in 2 weeks it's going to go out, you know, come hell or high water. No, it's you know, you make sure you,
yeah,
can,
well, it feels a bit like that. It's a boutique thing, you know. Mm. When you're doing something on your own and it's an internet based thing, and I'm not really doing it in a commercial aspect, you know, it's more about having this go out for like a book.
Sure.
And you know, it's going to, you know, you're not looking at singles, you're not looking at radio, you're looking at a 6 month push for people that are going to buy a record that enjoy the music. You know, I really feel it for that. We're not looking to make a profit. It's about me just getting my music out at this point and caring about that people get the message, and hopefully they'll feed back to me and, sure, I'll feed back to them. It's a totally different thing for me.
Well, the bad news is you will make a profit. I hate to tell you that.
But he's going to give it all to me. He said
well, he didn't say he'd refuse the profit. He just said he wasn't.
The funny thing was, when Bobby was doing the Grace Note thing, I noticed that the author of the song was changing, and I had no control over it.
Artist Bob Summerfield.
Yeah.
Vocals, bass.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to tell you, I have an announcement to make.
You're pregnant again.
Actually, tell us about your dad.
Yeah, yeah. Is he doing good, your dad?
My dad is doing really great. Thank you.
Good, all right.
He's doing really good, and I appreciate you asking. The announcement that I have is I'm going to be starting another podcast, and the podcast is called Practical Autism Podcast, and my son's autistic, and it's going to be a podcast for parents of autistic kids.
Wow.
So, and we're not going to really get too hung up on the science or the debates that are out there. It's going to be a podcast where parents are going to be helping other parents deal with everything from, you know, getting your kid to eat, to going to bed, to, you know, my son has 30-minute meltdowns. This is what I do to pull him out of it. And so, I just want to encourage anybody who's listening, our first podcast is going to happen in November, and the site's going to go live in December. So it's going to be at practicalautism.com if you're interested or you have any friends or family. But it's a really big need out there. And
how often are you going to do it?
We're going to start monthly.
Cool.
And it's just going to be, you know, a monthly thing.
And you don't want us to come, do you?
it's going to be kind of modeled after our podcast here. We're going to get people sitting around.
Though it'll have information people actually need.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. That's
no,
true.
We're just, you know, we're going to keep it, you know, lively, and just, you know, there's a okay. lot of people out there that are struggling with, you know, their parents have special needs kids. And so we're just going to bring some people together and see if we can help each other out, because, you know, autism, just there's a lot of debate about, you know, the source of autism and things like that, and we're just going to cut through all that. It's more about the people. It's more about the people that are out there having to deal with it. You know?
It's amazing the high number of autistic kids these
yeah,
days. It's crazy. 166.
Yeah.
Right, sorry.
And it's you know, we're gonna do shows with siblings of autistic. You know, kids, and because it's
mates.
Hard.
I've got two mates. One's a musician.
Yeah. So anyhow, I just wanted to encourage people. We're going to be going live probably at the end of November, early December at practicalautism.com. If you go there right now, you'll just see a placeholder for NetFirms where we're going to be hosting the site. But that should be something kind of cool. And
very
I'm
good
really
for you, Mike.
Forward to it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I just want to encourage everybody, if you have any questions or comments you want to reach us, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we also got a MySpace page, so you can join us there and you can post a comment. But anybody have anything else before we go?
No.
Yeah, not really.
All right.
Now, well, do Bobby and I have to stay for like 5 minutes?
Yeah, yeah, stay out because we're nosy boys.
have to sit in the corner.
Martin and Andrew and myself are going to be signing off, and Bobby and Rob are still going to be talking.
About Martin and Mike and Andrew.
Yeah, exactly. Glad they're gone.
Well, hey, we'll see you next time, guys, and take it easy.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropalo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
I guess it's just us
now.
Isn't
that great? That's so much better without those lot, isn't it?
Finally.
He keeps asking such silly questions. What EQ, what does that mean? I've
what
often
was
wondered.
That thing about EQ? What is EQ?
I don't know what it was. I was reading from this real book. It says EQ. I don't know. It's terrible.
I don't get it. Okay. Isn't that magazine with the men's fashions?